Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello, I'm Michael Chakraverty.
And I'm Mark Watson.
And this is the Menkind Podcast. We're going to take a deep dive into masculinity, exploring what being a man actually means, along with a variety of brilliant guests.
You know, men talking about men is a notoriously underrepresented area of podcasting. Not anymore.
Good morning, happy Monday. Michael here, Mark there. How are you, Mark?
Well, Michael, you always ask me, and some days are better than others. I'm not that happy today.
Do you want to talk about it, or will we do that while everyone else listens to...
Well, it's pouring with rain outside, which we've established generally makes me gloomy, and I have an outdoor show tonight, so I'm probably going to sort of have an unpleasant time. Anyway, we normally just say, oh, I'm fine, how are you? But I thought perhaps people would like a glimpse into reality there.
It's really nice when someone says, how are you? And someone actually answers the question rather than just saying, I'm good, how are you? So that's nice. We like that.
It's a big move to answer by saying, crippled by feelings of inadequacy, Michael. But again, sometimes truth is more valuable than politeness.
Truth is more valuable. But lest we just turn this into a therapy session, we do want to thank our Patreons. We've got some new Patreons this week, haven't we, Mark?
Yes. Well, I'm going to keep calling them patrons, but it's one of those... aluminium, aluminum thing. We can all be friends about it. Our new patrons are... It's not your fault. It's very confusing the way it's done. Anyway, Ben and Victoria are the two heroes who have boarded the Patreon ship, I'm going to say, this week. So, thank you to both Ben and Victoria.
And we wish them a better Monday than everybody else.
Yeah, we have set our stall out doing that now. So unfortunately, once more, we have to... So there's just two people walking around who are going to have a better Monday than everybody else listening to this.
Two people having the best Monday, then 32 other patrons having like a really good Monday, and everyone else just...
And then a standard or bad Monday for everyone below.
Yes,
that
absolutely.
Line.
Absolutely. Yeah.
We're sorry to keep making these threats. We want everybody listening to have a nice Monday, but there's only one way of guaranteeing that.
But a particularly good Monday today, for we do have the lovely Mossin Zeddy today.
All right.
I just wanted to establish my territory because Michael can be a bit sort of undermining of me sometimes, and I just like to play my way in.
Well, I actually have experience of that undermining because before we started hitting record, he was taking the mickey out of my microphone.
He was indeed, wasn't he? He regarded your microphone as being a bit frumpy looking compared with the microphone he possesses, which he claims. Well, do you remember the phrase he used about his own microphone?
Yeah, understated elegance, I think it was.
Yes, Mossin is a really brilliant man, and he has just released his paperback of his book, A Dutiful Boy, which is genuinely gorgeous. I read it all in one night, which was bad for me the next day, but I had a wonderful evening. Really beautifully written as well.
Yes, it is. I second that, and the book has made quite a bit of an impact already, I think, for reasons which will, I guess, become clear when we chat a little bit to Mossin. I'm going to stick my neck out and say that I think this was one of the best ones that we've had. I found him extremely interesting and, again, a perspective we haven't heard a lot of before.
Yeah, so enjoy it in your ears and we'll see you on the other side.
I'm Mark Watson, this is Michael Chakraverty opposite me, and we are joined by Mossin Zeddy. Hello, Mossin.
Hello.
That was good, wasn't it?
That was good.
Really neat, efficient intro by
efficient
me.
Efficient start.
I thought you were going to ask me to say something else. So.
I am going to ask you a question, yeah, but I just wanted to establish my territory because Michael can be a bit sort of undermining of me sometimes, and I just like to play my way in.
Well, I actually have experience of that undermining because before we started hitting record, he was taking the mickey out of my microphone.
He was indeed, wasn't he? He regarded your microphone as being a bit frumpy looking compared with the microphone he possesses, which he claims. Do you remember the phrase he used about his own microphone?
Yeah, understand. understated elegance, I think it was.
He claimed his own mic. He had bought a mic with understated elegance, yes.
I was half tempted to do a Patsy Palmer and just close the laptop lid and walk off like she did on Good Morning Britain.
Very good. One day we'll lose a guest. One day we'll lose one. And we'll put it out as a special edition and we won't mention that it's only 4 minutes long. People will think that they've had a downloading error or something.
Back on topic, though, you tried to introduce the podcast, but Mark, this is why I normally have to start, because it doesn't go anywhere.
I was going to ask the customary first question, which I now will ask. Mohsin, how do you normally describe yourself to people?
So I try not to, because it feels really arrogant, but I am a criminal barrister and recently the author of a memoir called A Dutiful Boy. I have actually written another book, which was called The Little Book of Insider Dealing, and it's a criminal text which three people read.
Oh, yeah. But did they like it?
Well, two of them were the authors, me and the co-author, and the other one was my mum, and I think she was lying. So I don't...
In general, you don't want the number of authors to outnumber the readers, really.
Yeah, well, they don't. There were three.
I know, I suppose, yeah.
To be fair, though, Dutiful Boy has been a big success, surely. Like, everyone is loving that.
Like, more than three readers, I heard.
Yeah, I think, actually, Dutiful Boy has been all right. So my second outing as an author has been slightly better than my first.
And how's your lockdown been? Well, you were going to get married, weren't you?
Yeah, lockdown has been miserable. I'm not going to lie. I mean, look, you know, I have a job and a roof over my head, so I'm very lucky, but I hate being inside. My wedding was cancelled and then the book was postponed. And then when it was published in lockdown, which sucks because you don't get to do any of the fun bits of publishing the book.
I had the same experience. It's a weird, empty feeling when your book is, in inverted commas, launched and all that happens is a tweet, essentially. You have to pour your own crap wine into a glass.
Yeah, and you're kind of sat in your living room. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But I think more than that, like, there was this book written years ago called Quiet, and it was about introverts in an extroverted world. And I feel like somebody needs to write the opposite, because I'm an extrovert in an introverted world and I really just want to get out.
I am very similar to you in that regard. And without wanting to do down anybody who might be more of an introvert than me listening, I am starting to get tired of all these. Already there are opinion pieces saying, oh, do you sort of miss lockdown?
Absolutely.
Or
not.
Did you sneakily enjoy it? I've seen half a dozen of those in the past week. And I say that, what I mean is I've seen the headlines on Twitter and reacted furiously without engaging at all, which is how you use Twitter. I completely understand some people's reasons for having enjoyed aspects of all this seclusion, especially people who are anxious or, you know, find social life difficult. But I mean, bloody hell, it's been enough of this, hasn't it?
No, I know. I'm sick of it. Like, I was with a mate the other day and he was like, oh, I think actually I'm quite happy for this to go on for quite a while. And it took everything not to hit him, actually.
I've been punching people left, right and centre when they say that, yeah. I mean, this business of being an extrovert is interesting, though. Have you always been sort of a gregarious person? Because obviously you were growing up in an environment where, well, yeah. Can you talk a bit about...
Really well-worded question, that, isn't it, Mohsin?
Yeah, I like that.
Really easy to respond to as well.
Perfectly articulated.
Michael's catty today, but sometimes the listeners enjoy that.
I had noticed.
I nearly segued directly into the question about one's first brush with masculinity, but I thought you might like to do that.
I do like that. I like to feel sort of important. Structure. But I think it's an interesting question. Like, have you always been an extrovert as a personality type?
I think that I was at school an extrovert trapped inside a quiet person's body. Mm. Unfortunately, school was complicated for me because... although I sound terribly middle class, I actually am from really working class background and I sounded exactly the same at school. And I really worked hard in a school where actually people didn't as much. So there were lots of reasons why I got bullied. So I found it easier not to speak. So I didn't speak very much. And then it was only when I got to university that I realized, actually, I quite like talking and it's quite enjoyable.
I could do more of this.
And therefore became a barrister.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I guess it was always there somewhere, but it took a while to come out. A bit like my sexuality, actually.
Well, I was about to say, yeah.
Yeah, this feels like an open goal of a link, really.
We'll definitely come to that, because I think it's really fascinating. But the first question we do ask everybody is what the first brushes with masculinity were, and when you first remember kind of realising that masculinity existed as a concept. Mm. Yeah, and when was that for you?
Exactly, to the day, please.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, actually, it was around the time that Hit Me Baby One More Time by Britney Spears was out, so I probably could tell you the month, at least.
And that is exactly the sort of dating that Michael likes, by the way.
Yeah.
He likes everything to be indexed.
A bit of diva dating we love.
Yeah, good. Well, I was watching it on TV and I can't remember how old I was, but I was quite young. And it's an infectious song. I got up and I started dancing and I was just gyrating around our living room. And I was actually singing out loud as well. And I kind of turned around and my dad was standing at the door. Like, my Pakistani Muslim father was standing at the door, mortified at this spectacle of his son gyrating to Britney Spears. And he said something and all he said was, don't ever do this again.
Why?
So as soon as you asked that question, my mind went there, because he didn't say you're acting like a woman or you're not acting manly enough, but he said, don't ever do this again. And I knew immediately what he meant by this. And it was a kind of like silent understanding between us.
Under the umbrella of this was basically any non-traditionally masculine behaviour or performance or implied.
Yeah, I don't know whether he was talking specifically about sexuality or just...
Maybe just thought you were a bad dancer?
Yeah.
I mean, how was the gyrating? How were your hips?
To be honest, I danced in the opening ceremony of the Olympic Games. I was a backing dancer to Dizzy Rascal.
Wait a minute. Hang on a second.
Why isn't this the thing you lead with?
We're going to fire our researcher.
Do you want to start the recording again? Yeah. Like, no, intro with that.
Hi, I'm Austin Zeddy. I'm a backing dancer to Dizzy Rascal.
I'm a backing dancer to Dizzy Rascal.
I don't think it would take Michael as long as it has taken you to mention that if that was in Michael's CV.
That's incredible.
Anyway, so I don't think it was the dancing.
Not too many people have been a criminal barrister, but also backing dancers Dizzy Rascal in one lifetime.
Well, there we go. That's why I wrote a book.
Were there any further conversations after that about that sort of thing that happened in your house? Or was it just an unspoken rule, I suppose, that you had to kind of toe a line?
No, I think it's like when people ask me about growing up in a religious household, like, were you ever told it was wrong to be gay? No, it's never as overt as that. It was this kind of subtle understanding of what is acceptable and what is not acceptable and where the line is. And so, no, other than that one comment, we never really spoke about it.
And do you think the attitude towards homosexuality was based on the religion or based more on the culture, I suppose? Were you going to ask the same question?
I was going to ask the exact same question because I'm always interested. It's very difficult to disentangle one from the other, isn't it? But it's always interesting to know where these parameters, where these norms come from.
Yeah, what I found really interesting when reading your book, the effect I was left with was the separation almost between the culture and the religion. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I understand that you kind of culturally still see yourself as Muslim, like you follow some kind of cultural aspect of the religion, but you don't follow the religion itself.
Yeah.
And so I'm kind of interested in terms of where you thought that homophobia, which is essentially what it was, or outdated perhaps views towards homosexuality.
Yeah.
Do you think that was a more religious-based thing, or was it more to do with the kind of culture of Pakistan?
Well, I think it's important to say at the outset that I grew up in London, and London in the early 90s was, the UK was a homophobic place, right?
Yeah.
We had, there was Section 28, there was lots of other stuff that was going on. It was in the backdrop of Margaret Thatcher having just been in power.
Yeah.
So the first layer of homophobia came from the country that we were in.
Yeah, 100%.
Because I think a lot of the time people interview me and they're like, oh, so, you know, what was it like? Was it because you were Muslim? I'm like, well, hold on a second. If you think about the date and the time.
No. It's because I was in England, yeah.
You lot were dealing with homophobia too, yeah. But having said that, of course, there is an extra dynamic to it, which is around culture and faith. And I think the answer is it really depends on who you're talking to. Because for my parents, the answer would be different to some other people. Mm. So I think for my parents, it was a bit of column A, a bit of column B. Mm. I think what it really came down to was actually culture, because they had a very firm idea of what my future would look like. I would marry a woman, I would, you know, move in next door, have kids, and then we'd all grow old together. And I think that me saying that I was gay just challenged their worldview, but also challenged their dreams, right? They had a very, actually a really romantically lovely idea of family. And I think that they'd never been shown an example of a different type of family. And so for them, they were like, okay, well, this means our version of family can no longer exist.
Yeah.
So I think that at the heart of it, in my case, it was challenging the notion of family for my parents.
It's really interesting, isn't it? We've made leaps and bounds, obviously, to where we are currently, doing a massive jump from the 90s to now, but we aren't fully there yet in terms of representation.
No.
And even responses from families, people across the world, I suppose, the response is, oh, but the future I saw for you won't look the same now, and you won't have the family or the children. And it's a really well-worn narrative, I suppose, because it's so entrenched, is the fact that gay people won't have families in the same way, or trans people can't have families in the same way. And I think it's a really interesting observation that actually if representation and education was better in terms of knowing that everybody can have families, no matter what they look like, I do wonder whether that would unpick quite a lot of the shame and stigma around coming out.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the reasons to write the book, actually, was because I was tired of feeling ashamed, and I was tired of being told, okay, well, you're gay, that means that, well, you can't be with your family anymore because you have to embrace the Western ideals and Western notions of things, and you have to leave everything else behind. And I remember I was on a train platform a couple of months ago, and I got a message on social media from somebody randomly, and it was a mother, a very religious mother, who was writing to me to say that she had thought that her son belonged in hell, and that reading the book, she wasn't actually a Muslim mother, but she was of faith, and reading the book made her see her own lived experience, but through somebody else's eyes. And she felt really bad for not having centered her son's experience and instead focusing on herself and on her faith. And it just, for me, it was, to be completely honest with you, I cried on the platform because I was so like, this is why I wrote this book, for moments like this, so that few people could feel less alone and so that parents could see another version of family.
I think also your book doesn't just center on your experience. It's about you, obviously. It's a memoir. But the way you framed your parents was really respectful and also kind of curious in terms of understanding where they came from and why they did what they did. And I think it probably bears saying that you have a good relationship, I believe, currently with your parents, and they've come on leaps and bounds, and the stuff that they've done and the work they put in to become supportive has been incredible. And I think that in itself is inspirational, seeing people go from a place of not accepting to almost promoting and saying we're proud and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, when people ask me about what the situation is with my parents now, the easiest way to put it is my fiance's name is Matthew, and they genuinely love Matthew more than they love me. And I think that means that I'm marrying the right person.
Yeah, it's a bit of a sacrifice you've had to make to get on side with your parents.
Yeah, absolutely.
Put a better person in your place.
Yes.
Offer them an alternative son. But
exactly.
Whatever works, I guess.
Yeah.
Do you think, I mean, this is a question which might sound...
strap in, Mossin. He looks uncomfortable.
Oh, God.
It's a question raised by things I've read that you've written. I mean, it has the potential to sound like an Islamophobic question, but I've asked similar questions of people who grew up in Christian and Jewish backgrounds and things.
Sure.
I find it very interesting what you've said about being, well, yeah, culturally Muslim, but detached from some of the actual rituals or articles of faith, or, you know, some of the day-to-day obviously now. Do you think that not just Islam, but religious conventions can modernise? And basically, do you think we can live in a world where people can still be Christians or Muslims, but accommodate gay people better than they have for generations? I'm sure I've read you saying that punishment for homosexuality was not an intrinsic part of Islam for a long time, for example.
Yeah, so I'm not an expert on theology, and so I try not to focus too much on the theological answer, but there are academics who have argued that Islam and homosexuality, and actually Catholicism or Judaism and homosexuality, there's nothing irreconcilable about those two things.
Yeah.
I mean, by way of example, the word sodomy doesn't appear in the Quran.
Yeah.
And so people are like, well, how can you say it's illegal if it doesn't even appear in the religious text?
Right.
For me, I guess the point is that religion is a deeply personal thing, and I can't tell somebody what to believe or whether or not they have to accept homosexuality as part of their faith or not.
Mm.
What I can say is some of those people will have queer children.
Yeah.
And those children, like me, will be suicidal for the way they were born unless they are supported and loved and cared for in the way that they should be.
Yeah.
And if we can't agree on religion, I would hope that the one thing we can agree on is that they don't want their kids to be suicidal.
Yeah. Yeah. You'd think that any religion, in fact, would try and not want anybody to be suicidal.
Yeah. But also, there is space in religion for those things. I mean, actually, there are really vibrant queer communities of faith in this country and all over the world. And I think religion does give people hope, and I think it gives people belonging. And I have a lot of respect for my family's faith. They're fasting at the moment, and they derive a lot from their faith.
Absolutely.
So I think it can be a force for good as well as problematic.
So do I, and that's why I kind of remain hopeful that there's a way that religion can continue to animate people's lives and choices, but without excluding the lives and choices of other. We spoke to a gay Christian a couple of episodes ago. I'm very interested in these kind of hinterlands between the kind of buttoned down traditions of religion. And because, as you say, it is inevitable that lots of people belonging to faith or born into faith will also be queer. And now that we know that we live in that world, I'm really interested in what happens next.
Yeah, I'm not of faith, but I'd see the values that people have in religion and the amount of meaning they can attach to it. And it genuinely does bring light and joy to so many people.
Mm.
And I think it is so fascinating to kind of think, how do we apply what needs to be applied to it and make sure people feel accepted and comfortable within the wider conversations around its history and its past, which can't also be ignored.
Yeah.
What violence has been enacted in its name, whether or not that could actually accurately be ascribed to it. You did write about conversion therapy.
Yeah.
It was a witch doctor, wasn't it, that came,
yeah,
which I thought was really powerful. And there's lots of conversations around it at the moment, considering the government having pledged to ban conversion therapy in the UK, but not quite acted on that in the many years since they said they were going to do so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know you talk about it in the book, but would you mind just giving a kind of an overview of what that experience was like for you?
I came home a week after coming out to my dad, came home from the library, and I could tell something was up because my brother and my dad were, and my mum were constantly like, where are you? Where are you? Where are you? And when I got home, there was a man waiting in the living room, and my dad told me that he wanted to speak to me. So we went for a walk nearby, and this man who was the witch doctor was saying, you know, your parents have told me that you've told them something recently. Do you want to tell me yourself? And I was like, well, I've told them that I'm gay. And he was like, who told you that you're gay? And I was like, well, nobody told me. I just know.
You don't really get notified of it officially.
No, you didn't. And I was going to be like, well, I could give you some details, but I don't think you want to hear them.
You might wish you hadn't asked the question.
Yeah, exactly. But basically, he kept challenging me on the idea that I was gay. And then he said that he'd helped other people. And that really pissed me off because I just thought, how dare you? By this point, I was in my mid-20s. I was already a lawyer. I was almost a lawyer. I kind of was really comfortable with who I was, and nobody could tell me any different. But there were so many, I just imagined all these kids that are still being exploited today, by the way, that he was abusing,
right? And exploiting the vulnerability of their parents who are desperate to try and quote unquote save them. But nothing I said was landing with him. And it was really frustrating me. So eventually I just said, look, are you gay? And he was like, what? Excuse me? And I was like, what, are you gay?
Big move.
Yeah, power move, yeah.
And he was like, I was like, are you or not? I've answered your questions, now answer mine. So he was like, no, of course not. Like, how dare you even suggest it? Blah, 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 blah. I was like, okay, so then you don't know, do you? Like, for all you know, all of these people are lying to you because that's what their parents want to hear. And I'm not going to lie to you. You're wasting my time.
At this point, he starts to wish he hadn't been called to see a barrister.
Yeah. He called me the most stubborn young man he'd ever met.
Someone that's excelled in debating that's in their mid-20s.
Something else to add to the list as well. Back in Dance of a Ditty Rascal, most stubborn person the Witch Doctor has ever met.
Quite a number
of different accolades on your mantelpiece.
Accolades, yeah. Exactly. God, I really should do that intro again. but anyway, so then we went home and he held up this ointment and he wanted me to drink it. And I refused. And my dad said, please do it for me. And I said, Dad, you're the reason that I'm not going to do it, because every day I drink this is yet another day where you think this is going to change and it's not going to change.
That's really brave, with that one to be patronizing. I mean, I think I'd have just probably drunk it.
Well, yeah. So that's the thing, right? Is 5 years earlier, I think this is one of the things I say in the article. 5 years earlier, I would have downed the damn thing. You know, I would have just been like clambering for it. And I think that's why I feel so strongly about conversion therapy, because it's such an abuse.
Yeah.
If there was some people, a team of people going around the country, going into people's homes and assaulting children, we would not stand for it. It would be on the front page of every newspaper. And that's what these people are doing. And yet they're getting away with it.
Yeah. I was astonished. Again, it's quite a cis privileged point of view, but I did not understand the extent of conversion therapy that still goes on until the recent spate of news articles about it. I was amazed by the notion of it,
yeah,
and by the presupposition that being gay is something you need to be cured of. I mean, it seems so very primitive.
Yeah.
So you're right, it's astonishing.
And that it's still seen as a thing that people turn to in hope that they can fix something. There's so much to unpick in it, and I think the more stories that can be shared about it is the most important thing, because the more people show the impact it can have on people, the more change it can bring.
Absolutely. But also, like, making it unlawful, it sends a really important message. Yeah, the way that gay marriage sent a message of, okay, this is something we accept as a society. Saying from the outset, this is now illegal, it tells young people, actually, well, there's a reason why people are not allowed to do this, why it's unlawful.
Yeah, in the same way that people aren't legally allowed to practice other forms of medicine which are out and out harmful.
Yeah, exactly.
Which have been medically discredited. Although, again, as you say, it can take years before that changes as well.
Mm. And like you say, Martin, it's scary to think. I mean, you were lucky because you were confident and felt able to fight your corner.
Absolutely.
But there are so many people for whom that happens not in their 20s, when they're in their teens, or even younger than that, for whom they don't feel able to fight.
Mm.
It's one of the reasons we do the podcast, I suppose you could say.
To share
because
stories.
Because we're aware that those stories need telling. It's what people need to hear them. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I mean, the gay stuff's really interesting, Martin, but it's not all you are. So let's talk about something else. I mean, boring, well, gay.
You might not even be gay if that goes right.
Exactly, yeah.
True.
Well, I'm still testing the theory.
Fair play. Yep, keep doing the groundwork.
You mentioned earlier growing up in a working class background, a working class area, which I think is really interesting in terms of masculinity, in terms of the archetypal macho man is a kind of a working class, he's a worker, he's tough and he's all these sorts of things. You mentioned that you were bullied when you were growing up at school.
Yeah.
Did that have relation to class? You mentioned your voice and things like that.
Yeah, I suppose partly it was class just because I sounded ridiculous. Like, you know, like imagine sounding like this in a proper East London comprehensive.
Yeah, we're in Walthamstow. That's where I live now.
Yeah. You live in Walthamstow?
I do, yeah.
Oh no, you're one of those.
One of the assholes that have led to it being gentrified.
Yeah, which means I can't afford to buy my house that I grew up in.
Yeah, that's right, mate. That's me.
So class was part of it, as I said, because I sounded like this. But a lot of it was also to do with the idea of masculinity, of what it meant to be a boy in East London, right? Mm. So for, you said macho man, but for me, it was rude boy or bad man. Like
right,
it was slang. It was kind of the way you walk, what you are interested in, what you're not interested in, the music you listen to. Like there was all this, there was expectations around a certain way of being. And I tried to conform, but I did a really bad job. Like hearing me speak slang, it's ridiculous. You know, it just sounds so stupid.
Can you give us a couple of lines, Marcin?
God, no, no.
You can't put a man on the spot like that.
I also can't think of any slang that I could ask him to say. So, I mean,
this is like when you asked Nikesh Shukla to rap.
Yeah, Nikesh didn't want to rap.
He nearly hid under the table.
I still hope that he'll send me a voice note in the future.
He might. You have to keep it. Put it on the Patreon. But yeah, I take your point. You're aware that you can't fake it in those situations.
So thinking of like a rude boy or a bad man, what did they look like? What was that vision of masculinity? What kind of attributes?
Well, I think it was... So do you remember Craig David had those kind of lines on his beard? They weren't. It wasn't a beard. It was just like a ridiculous looking line. And so that
I couldn't even call it a beard, really.
It was. So that was part of it, I think, at some point when garage music, which I really like, actually was kicking off. I mean, it's funny now because now, of course, the working class aesthetic has been co-opted by luxury brands so that they can basically commoditize poor people and the poor aesthetic. But
try to sell their aesthetic back to them.
Exactly, yeah. So back then, you know, Kappa jogging bottoms and stuff were not cool. They were just what you could afford and that's what you wore. And so that was part of it. And so, yeah, I dressed the part. In fact, the funny thing about it is that I dressed the part all the way to university to begin with because I didn't know how else to dress. And then I got mistaken for being a drug dealer in uni Freshers Week. And so then I was like, okay, I need to go to Gap and buy some polo shirts.
Yeah, being mistaken for a drug dealer in Freshers Week, is it the first sign that you might have mistaken the dress code at the institution you've come to? Yes.
But I like that you went for polo shirts. That's very Oxbridge, isn't it?
Well, yeah, because there was, so I write about this, right? On Facebook, which was new at the time, there was this Facebook group that said, wearing your collars down is for poor people.
God.
And I genuinely didn't know whether to wear them up so that people couldn't tell I was poor, or wear them down because I shouldn't be lying. Like, it was really complicated.
The honesty of the polo neck.
Yes.
Yeah. I was like, up, down, up, down.
So much emotionally invested in the collar of your shirt. Very difficult.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't a class thing in my case, but I remember that early university panic about what to... I remember a panicky visit to Edinburgh Woolen Mill, which I don't think that would ever happen again in my life.
Until you're 94.
It's because I'd seen someone else in Freshers Week wearing something that, like, some sort of awful... I don't know what you'd even call it, really, but like a lumberjack shirt. And I thought, this must be what you do at Cambridge then.
I'm such an old man. That sounds lovely now. Like, Edinburgh Woolen Mill. Oh,
lovely navy cardigan, you know.
I wish I'd kept hold of all that stuff for my 40s, actually. Yeah.
It is interesting that, like, you kind of change what you wear to try and fit in with people. I mean, I went through like an emo phase when I was younger and I was wearing fingerless gloves, which are the most impractical thing in the entire world. What's the point? Your fingers are the bits that get cold. But like...
Either wear gloves or don't. Eh?
Well, yeah. But you try and dress in a certain way to try and attach yourself to the group of people that you want to be. But I think there's also qualities that you aspire to. Like, what qualities did a... I feel weird saying rude boy. I've said that so many times now because I feel like boy has an I and that makes me uncomfortable.
The problem is that we're talking about kids who grow up with no opportunities, right? They've got, they grow up in one of the richest cities in the world and yet they might as well be in a village in the middle of nowhere because they are treated as if they are criminals. They don't have the same access to extracurricular activities or educational opportunities or economic opportunities as most other kids. And so there, it doesn't seem like there's very much to aspire to other than this one very particular way of being. Mm. And so, for example, some of my relatives, I won't go into too many of the details, but some of my relatives were drug dealers. So at one point in life, I thought, wow, I want to drive a Range Rover. I'm going to be a drug dealer. And you think it sounds ridiculous, but it's actually deeply sad that that's what we as a society allow to happen under our watch with these kids.
Absolutely. It doesn't really sound ridiculous. It's inevitable that kids want, you have to aspire to something and you will attach value to whatever you can see, which is beyond the life that you're currently offered, as you say. And in the case of the kids that you're talking about, that life is so incredibly constrained that it's very easy to see how almost anything becomes attractive as a thing to belong to and want.
When you were younger, were there people that you admired, that you looked up to and thought, I want to be like them? I know you've mentioned the, perhaps not the drug dealer thing that you want to mention, but like, were there any positive models of masculinity that you looked at? And that could be to do with sexuality or race or class or anything, but who did you look up to?
So I think that the person that I looked up to the most was my uncle, my uncle Thai.
It's a gorgeous relationship in the book, actually, a really beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, I get quite emotional talking about him because he passed away from cancer a couple of years ago, but he was just the most wonderful man. He was a generation below my mum and a generation above me, and he was my mum's younger brother, and he loved George Michael. He was probably the only straight man that does, but he loves George Michael.
I like George Michael, just to reassure you.
Oh, do you?
Also,
yeah,
so do I, yeah.
Yeah, but you're not entirely straight, Michael.
Well, a bit. Aren't we all a bit?
All right, maybe there's more than one straight man that likes George Michael, but he was
yeah, it was more than the music for me, I suppose.
Yeah.
But yeah, so he used to like dance around our living room. It kind of defied all of these notions I had of what it meant to be a good Pakistani.
Mm.
And he would just like make me sit on the sofa with my brother, and he would just be like dancing away. And he'd be like, I was in the club the other night and these are the moves I was pulling. And he was like, you know, throwing moves out.
This is one of these cool uncles that, because they're younger than your mum, they like that thing of slipping into the generation gap between you and your parent. Everyone could do with a sort of surprisingly young uncle like that.
I'm interested, Martin, in his hips. If you could just describe how did his hips lie, in the words of Shakira? Was this before or after the Britney experience?
Or did his hips have integrity?
His hips never lied. Never. Not once.
In a serious note, was this before or after the Britney incident?
This was afterwards.
Wow, okay.
So, well, I guess it was a bit before, a bit after, but it was because, you know, obviously he was my uncle, so he was always around. But I just got to watch him going through his late teens and his 20s as I was in my, I must have been 7 or 8.
Yeah.
It was so different to how my parents had said I should behave.
Yeah.
But also he just taught me to be kind. It was so important to him to try and do right by other people. And like, you know, we'd be walking down the street, and I remember this one really vivid experience where we're walking down the street and this woman across the road who was carrying loads of bags, she was clearly struggling. And he said, come on, son, because he used to call me son as his nickname. And we crossed over and we just helped this woman to her door. And I don't know how long the walk was because I was too young, but it was quite far.
Mm.
And like, I'd totally forgotten that experience until a few months ago when I saw a woman struggling with her bags and I crossed over and I helped her home because I thought of him. And, you know, you don't realize sometimes.
I love that, by the way. The way that small acts of kindness whisper to you through the years like that and embed themselves in your instincts.
Oh, that's a lovely way of putting it.
Yeah.
One of my most strongly held beliefs is that kindness reverberates in that way. So it's wonderful to hear an actual example of it.
Yeah. So yeah, he was probably the most important role model I had.
And he sounded like he was quite instrumental in your coming out and feeling comfortable with who you were. And
yeah, he was. I told my mum, his sister, and she, for a few days, couldn't bring herself to tell him, but she was clearly not herself. So he was stressing out because he thought, ironically, he thought she had cancer and he was really worried about her. And he kept calling me and saying, and I was at uni and he said, look, what's wrong? What's wrong? What's wrong? And I was like, I can't tell you. It has to be mum. As soon as he found out, he jumped in the car and came to Oxford to see me. And he just told me that he loved me exactly as I was and didn't want me to change, and that he was really proud of me and proud of the man I was becoming. And I just wish that every queer kid, every kid could have an uncle like that.
Mm.
Yeah.
Do you think how he is and who he was has informed who you are now, and in what ways?
Yeah, absolutely. He used to be the person I would call whenever there was a mistake or a problem or something good or I had a question. It's just like, I call him up and say, oh, I'm thinking of doing this. What do you think of this? And now that he's not here anymore, I find myself, I guess, rehearsing what I think the conversation would look like.
Yeah.
So if I'm in a particular situation, I think, okay, well, what would Uncle Thai say to me? What would he tell me to do? And so I think inevitably it does inform the way that I conduct myself, because I'm thinking he would be here to tell me what to do. And now he's not. So I have to figure out what he would say.
Yeah. And it's about wanting to be that person for others. Yourself, isn't it? It's about, that's one of the best things you can aspire to do with your life, I think, is to be that person that lodges in someone's head, even if you're not physically there anymore, to be a sort of compass for someone. It's a really moving idea, I think.
And the idea of being a compass, I mean, you've created that support group, I believe, for LGBTQ Muslim families. Do you want to talk a bit about that? Because I think that's really important in terms of creating space for that kindness and for those conversations, and also to work through the hard parts as well.
Yeah, so what I realised was that there were some organisations out there for queer Muslims, but there was nothing to support families. And I think that if we're going to change the way that families deal with homophobia, is to provide them with support and provide them with a safe space in which they can talk about how shit it is, because that's what my parents needed, right? I took my mum to this South Asian event and a few years before we set up the group, and all the parents were talking about how wonderful their kids were and how much they celebrated the fact that they were now gay. And the problem, I mean, that was lovely to see, but it was the opposite of what my mum needed. My mum needed somebody else who she could say, I really hate this and I find it really hard.
Absolutely. In the same way that parents always need or frequently need that more than they need everyone to be bragging about how great stuff is.
Yeah.
And it's really lovely to hear someone think about the other people in the situation, because when you come out to somebody, it's not just you that has to go through something. You're kind of coming to the end of what you're going through and they're beginning exactly. What they're starting.
Especially given the background, all of the baggage.
And that's where change comes. Change comes from the people who have it happen to them, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think the thing is, with me coming out, it was lonely for a long time, but as soon as I started telling people, it quickly stopped being lonely. And there was this whole community and now support operators. I'm on the board of Stonewall, and that's designed to help support people, queer people in this country. But if you're a parent and you're religious and you're from a community where it's shameful, when the coming out happens to you, and it does happen to you, as you've said, Michael, you can't turn to anybody. You can't tell your siblings or your family or your parents or your friends, because all of those people hold the same worldview you do. So who's there to challenge it?
Yeah. And there is always that competitiveness, of course. There is that sense that you're seeing, you talk about this, and it reminded me of my own mother, that there is, you know, part of the impact on your parent is this thing of like, well, shit, I must have done something wrong, or I'm not celebrating my son's queerness like these other mums are. There are so many layers of it for a parent, as you say.
Oh, my mum didn't worry about that. She does now.
It's an often overlooked thing. I think the idea of a support network for people dealing with what feels like a seismic change to their life stroke worldview is a really nice one. Important thing. There are far more resources to support gay people than there are to help the people around them understand it.
Yeah, exactly. So that's where the idea came from.
It's a really lovely idea. Do you have any kind of examples of change that it's made?
So the group's only met twice, and that's because I didn't want to set up a charity myself, because it's a lot of work. And also because I didn't want it to be about me. Like, you know, I didn't want it to be like, oh, look, everybody, I'm doing this thing. Like, I just wanted to get on with helping people. I didn't want it to be this platform. So I worked with an organization called the Inclusive Mosque Initiative, and they are a fantastic charity, but they don't have all that much resource. So they have lots of other things they need to do. So I think what I'm going to do is try and find some more funding for it so it can become a proper regular thing. But from the two or three times it did meet, I can't really convey just how powerful it was seeing parents be able to talk to each other.
Yeah.
Because these parents are scared. These parents are ashamed. And these parents have no vocabulary with which to articulate how they're feeling. And they can't even do it with their kids, because their kids are saying, well, you need to get used to this. And, you know, I tried to do that as well. Sometimes it was tough love. But then you get them coming together and suddenly they're bonding over making jokes about future son-in-laws or future daughter-in-laws and like who they're going to not be able to invite to the wedding. And they're taking all these really actually quite sad things, but turning them into lightheartedness because they can do that in this safe space.
Yeah.
So I guess even in those two, three meetings that we had, I could see that it was proving transformative. And then there was this WhatsApp group that was set up with some of them. So I think it, hopefully it's helped.
Yeah.
I'm sure it has helped. It sounds great.
Something else that popped into my head from the book was your experience of race within the queer community, because I think often we talk about how when you come out, you have this community of people who are there for you, and that's wonderful. But that community itself is deeply problematic in many different ways, often internally against one another. But there is a racial aspect to it, which I think is really fascinating and isn't really spoken about enough. And I really appreciated reading a bit about that from your perspective. And I was wondering if you could give us any examples, I suppose, of some of the challenges you face within the gay community with regard to race.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know why. And obviously, I have no statistics to back it up.
Always good when someone starts a sentence like that.
Yeah, I know.
Good.
No. Yeah. Exactly. There is no evidence for all of that so far.
Yeah, but
I can't say I've got away with that in court.
I was going to say, you might have to be a bit more forensic than this.
I sense that the prejudice that exists in the wider population becomes more acute in the gay community. And I'm talking specifically about the gay white male community.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why. I wonder whether partly it's because as a queer person, you've gone through feelings of otherness and not feeling like you belong. And so maybe that makes them think that they have free license to do and say whatever comes to their minds, however offensive it might be.
We've talked about this before. I would have always imagined that that experience of your own otherness would enable you to have greater empathy towards other people in that situation, but it often doesn't play out like that. We know that from the world.
No, exactly.
The oppressed find it much easier to then oppress.
It does make sense.
It's learned behaviour, I suppose, in a way.
Yeah, it's weird. It surprised me. Before joining Stonewall, I was on the board of Pride in London, and I won't go into that too much because there's a lot going on there, but I found that deeply problematic, and that's why I left. And I was surprised because I expected queer people in London to totally get race, but it was such a naive worldview of mine. Mm. I guess the thing is it's easy to talk about the racism, which there is a lot of. I guess the more nuanced examples are things like, I went on a date once and this guy said, oh, you don't look Pakistani. And I was like, have you been to Pakistan? No. I was like, so what do you mean? And I kind of said it in quite a jokey way, but I was trying to get to like, and he was like, oh, I just mean that, you know, like, and I was like, do you want me to fill that sentence in? What you're saying is I don't look like a taxi driver or a shopkeeper. Mm. And I know it sounds really aggressive to do that on a date, but I was just like, ah, like you don't even get it.
Yeah, how'd the date go after that?
Let's just say that isn't the person that I'm marrying.
That would have been an amazing twist.
Yeah.
There is also a fetishization of it as well, I think.
Definitely. The same with any person of colour that you talk to about this issue who is relatively conscious. There are like a whole host of examples. I had a guy in a professional context come up to me and say, I've actually been seconded to our Dubai office, which is why we've not met before. I love brown boys. Can I take you for dinner? Like, and you're just like, oh my God, I should have reported him to HR. I wish I had now. But there's all this stuff that happens. I guess the thing about it is instead of it being about victimhood, it is about educating people, right? So it's about saying, what is it that is so problematic about those sorts of comments and why do you need to challenge them?
Yeah, my next question was, how do we change that? I mean, it's up to you, Martin, entirely to fix this, by the way.
Yeah, exactly.
In the next 30 seconds.
Yeah, you're not the first person to expect that, actually.
But like, I do often wonder like what steps there are. Well, we know representation works. We know being able to see people, like for example, on a poster of Pride, we expect a white, cisgendered, able-bodied man. That's kind of what you see as the face of Pride. It's changing slowly, but representation does breed change.
Yeah.
But I also don't think that's the only way we can do it. And yeah, I don't have an answer, but I'm interested to hear what your thoughts are in terms of how do we change it? Is it just calling it out whenever it happens? But that's exhausting.
I mean, I think that's part of it. And people have to decide for themselves whether they want to call things out as they happen or not. And, you know, everyone picks their battles. I'm the same. I think it would be helped by ceasing to center the white gay male experience, which is what we have historically done as a community. That Stonewall film is a really good example of doing that, right?
Like
where the first rock was thrown by, I think, a trans woman, and instead in the film, I haven't watched the film, but...
Yeah, it's Jeremy... Oh, it's the guy who's in Mamma Mia. He plays like a young one of the men. Jeremy something?
So the story's been...
They literally whitewashed it. So the original Stonewall, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, because Martin literally works for the organisation, but the original Stonewall was an uprising predominantly led by queer people of colour and particularly trans women of colour. And in this film, it was like a group of white boys and maybe one black or brown one, I think.
And that's what we mean by centering the game.
Literally, yeah. It's a prime example.
I think what's interesting about it is that class is also ignored so much of the time. And actually, class is so important to all of this. Mm. So you've got all these companies whose head of diversity is a privately educated white gay male.
Yeah, because they think that's diverse enough.
Exactly. And I think what I would really like to move away from is this idea of just because you happen to tick one box, that necessarily makes you diverse and means that you understand everything else about everybody else.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I guess moving towards a more sophisticated view of identity where intersectionality is centered, so intersectionality being like when you are more than one identity. So for example, I'm brown and from a working class background and gay. So it's just, it's less box ticking, more kind of thinking about it more carefully.
Yeah, and hopefully more amplification of those voices, because I think there are cisgendered white gay men who have platforms, but it would be nice if that was used, I suppose, to amplify voices of those who don't have those platforms yet. There's so much work to be done.
Yeah, but I think that applies a lot. That's why I mentioned class. It applies to race too, right?
Yeah.
When you've commentators talking about race, most of them are privately educated. Now, I'm really pleased that people are talking about race, right? But you then have the right wing saying, well, you went to Eton, so what are you complaining about?
Yeah.
And it's just like, oh my God. Because actually, in this country, if you are black or brown, you are disproportionately more likely also to be poor. So to talk about one without the other is complicated. And so I guess I would quite like to see a shift towards just more nuance when we talk about identity.
And I think often when we talk about race, people only really think about black or brown people, and Romani people, for example, just don't get a look in, or there's so many other, so much else. I mean, we've really opened the box here, so I'm just going to gently put the lid back on.
Well, this is the thing. Once you start caring about this stuff, you have to care about a lot of it, and that is why people take shortcuts, I suppose.
I do feel like we could talk forever, Martin, but I am going to guide us to our final question, which we always ask. Yeah.
You shouldn't say that to a barrister, probably.
What shouldn't I say?
You shouldn't say that we could talk forever. Professionally has that ability at the very least,
Get a filibuster from Martin today.
But yes, you're right. We have come to the traditional final question.
Yeah, which is, if you were to be building a man from scratch, in order for them to best function in today's society, for it to be the dream society that we've kind of talked about a little bit, what would you embed within them? I haven't even mentioned Build-A-Bear this time. I'm going to go without Build-A-Bear this time. We'll cut the analogy.
Yeah.
I get the concept. I mean, thank you for offering to, you know, explain it via Build-A-Bear.
Yeah, Yeah, but he's incredibly, he's managed to infer it without Build-A-Bear coming into it.
With the plain words you used. So I don't know if I'm the first guest to kind of take issue with this question, and I don't want to do that.
You aren't, but I love that. Do okay, it. Fine. Go, question us. Go, go, go.
You know, because sex is one thing, gender is another, right? Mm. But I guess that what you guys are trying to get at is, in this society, if I had a son, for example, how would I raise him? And I think I would hope to raise my child, regardless of gender, in the same way. So these three answers I would probably give for any for person anything. I was trying to, yeah.
So after dismantling gender, what you would then
after
do...
Exactly. After dismantling the patriarchy and gender,
yeah.
We would...
He's knocking the bears off the shelves here. It's a bull in a china shop.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So the three things, and they're inspired by my uncle Thai, because those are the things that he taught me to focus on. Integrity, generosity, and kindness. And I'm not just saying kindness because it's in your title of your podcast.
No, but it is inescapable, I think, if you care about, you know, there's a reason why it's in the title. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that they all...
Oh, a bit of drama here for the listeners.
Does that mean I got the answer right?
Yeah, that's right. It's the first time we've had that. We've never heard the klaxon before.
You've won.
You win a prize, yeah.
Yeah, what do I win?
You win Michael's fridge freezer.
I'm going to send you my bank details.
Sorry, yeah, so integrity, generosity and kindness. I'm really interested in generosity.
Yeah, so, well, actually, I think you guys might want to look at this afterwards. So Tony Parsons, who's a writer, he wrote for GQ.
I don't know who that is.
And one year, I don't even remember which year it was, he wrote something called a manifesto at the beginning of the year, pun intended with the word man. And he had all these different lines, really short kind of snippets of advice. And one of them was, be generous to the point of absurdity. And there is something in that line that I absolutely adore. It stayed with me. I think that there is so much to be gained by being generous to the point of absurdity.
I love that.
And I think that it feeds into the other two things, in particular, being generous with your integrity, but particularly being generous with your kindness. Mm. So, you know, giving people the benefit of the doubt, and also just, I guess, being able to acknowledge the privileges that you have. And I'm talking about me, because I try not to tell other people how to behave. I focus instead on how I can be a better version of myself. So how can I be kinder and more generous and conduct myself with integrity?
Well, that's lovely. That's a really nice thought.
It's pleasing when the three choices sort of dovetail in that way.
And as you heard, you won the prize.
Absolutely. I got the right answer. So
this is the ultimate answer. So we'll have to stop asking that question.
Yeah. Mic drop.
Before we go, we do like to ask you to plug things, which we will do. But also, would you like to redo your intro just quickly as a backing dancer of Dizzy Rascal and the most stubborn person the Witch Doctor has ever met?
I think this is unprecedented, is it, for someone to finish with an intro as well as starting with one.
So, Mossin, how do you introduce yourself?
Well, thank you for asking. Primarily, I'm famous for being a backing dancer to Dizzy Rascal in the 2012 Olympic Games. Dizzy and I go way back, although you might not remember me. And secondly, for famously being called the most stubborn man a witch doctor had ever met.
At last, the priorities are straight.
Thank you so much, Martin. Honestly, it's been genuinely fascinating.
Yeah, and just let people know where they can find you on social media.
Yeah, and your book as well, which
and
is brilliant.
The book, and so forth.
The book is called A Dutiful Boy. And I don't remember my social media handles. I think it's mossinzeddy.ldn, something like that.
If they Google you, they'll find you.
Well, if they can spell it.
I must say, the book I finished in a night. I stayed up really late. I read it in one night. It's genuinely beautiful and heartbreaking and gorgeous. So definitely do go and buy it.
Thank you.
I would definitely recommend it.
Thank you very much.
It's got a lovely cover as well. You look very adorable on the front.
You love to sleep as well. So that is an
endorsement. I do love to sleep. Thank you so much, Martin.
Yeah,
it's
great.
Been wonderful.
No, thank you for having me.
Have a wonderful day. Thank you.
Good luck. Bye-bye.
The enormous intellect and wit of Mossin Zeddy there. I enjoyed that.
Yes, really lovely conversation and really fascinating, although his mic was an unsatisfactory colour.
Yeah, you're very kind of, you will really beat people up over their microphone choices. Sometimes.
I didn't realise we were being recorded while I was beating him up about his Microsoft? About his mic. Oh my God, I'm so...
Don't worry, Michael, this is all good content. This is good content. Sometimes I think we're too flawless as broadcasters, so it's nice to just rein it in a bit, that perfection.
I can't get my words out today.
Yeah, you had problems with his microphone style choice, but his microphone did work well. And basically, if a guest's audio holds up for the whole hour, that's really all we want in life. We've had so many headaches with that stuff.
And on that note, we were halfway through recording our next guest when we had so many microphone issues that we had to stop. So we don't actually technically know whether we're going to have time to record them before next week. We're just being honest with you guys. We're being honest, open and vulnerable. We just don't know who's going to be here next week.
Yes, it could be. We hope it will be
someone by the name of Lane Rogers, who, as Michael says, we had sort of half a chat with, and we were beset by cross-Atlantic tech issues. And so it was a first in mankind history. I was going to say, actually, it's not quite a first. I was going to say it's the first time we've had a chat interrupted in that way. But then there was that time Jackie Cox, we lost her altogether because couldn't get back in the apartment.
Yeah, she did completely leave the podcast, that's true. But we can't now give you a clip of next week's episode because we just don't know who it'll be with or whether it will be just us talking for half an hour into your ears. So
yeah, if we haven't finished the chat with Lane Rogers, it could be quite literally anyone on planet Earth. So there you go, what a tease that is.
What a tease. But in the meantime, please do continue to keep in touch with us at Menkind Podcast on social media. That's Twitter and Instagram and I think Facebook. Although I think Facebook's for old people now, so I'm not really sure.
I mean, by old people, you mean us, though.
I mean yeah. You, yeah.
But
yeah.
I also, I'm not on Facebook, so either it's for even older people than me, or, yeah, there are reasons to be sort of wary of Facebook, I think. But we do check
things. Perhaps we're just not in the zeitgeist, because I think Instagram is technically Facebook. But get in touch with us anyway, or you can email us at menkindpodcast@gmail.com.
Yes, that's the oldest of them all, actually, email, and yet everyone does still use that, reassuringly. Those are always getting read, actually, so I think the actual inbox is the way to contact us.
The inbox is the best way to go, yes. And we had some lot of tweets, actually. Somebody mentioned David's episode a couple of weeks ago, David Atherton's, who said they loved the highlighting of the power of vulnerability and shame within the queer community, and that thinking about their first brush with masculinity was fascinating, which is great, because we came up with that question, so that's... That means that we're great, I guess.
I suppose it does, extraction. Yes. You are what you do, right? On this earth. Yeah. I don't know if I'm completely with it today, Michael, because I was about to start reading another lovely comment, and it is the same one, to be perfectly fair. I was just about to read vulnerability, shame, and driving force in the queer community, and I thought...
Well, why don't you read the message from lovely Beth?
Beth says, really nice to hear. So this relates to an old episode, I suppose you could say. Nathaniel Curtis... Talking on Menkind about how rejections are merely a change in direction feels very relevant for me right now in my desperate job hunting state. Well, I hope, Beth, that your job hunt has come to a satisfactory conclusion, because this was tweeted, about 10 days ago. And in fact, on my daughter's birthday, I note. So I hope that for my daughter's birthday, you got a new job, Beth. I don't know if that's how it works, but sometimes the universe just throws gifts in all directions, doesn't it?
And Patreons will know that you had a bit of a crisis over on Patreon about whether your daughter was your friend or not. And if you'd like to see similar crises, you can join our Patreon at patreon.com/menkindpodcast. We're quite consistent with our usernames everywhere, really.
Yeah, there's no messing about. It's always Menkind Podcast. That was an artfully achieved segue, I think, Michael.
Thank you. And the three price bands that we have on there, everyone gets the same content because we're all about equality. But the three price bands are Menkind, which is £5, Menkinder, which is £7, and Menkindist, which is £10. And we drop little extra bits from all the interviews, different videos each week, and Mark and I just write little messages every so often when we feel the
need. We do, actually. We do that quite often. I was just going to add, as a footnote, there was also a tweet about what Ben was saying about pointing his feet out. Do you remember that?
Ben Hurst last week.
Yeah. Someone called David says, totally understand the foot thing. I avoid and judge men walking with knees and feet outward. I make unfair assumptions. So there you go. We've made someone...
Well, my feet go outwards. I was actually doing a photo shoot last week and I was told to keep bringing my toes in because I was doing it wrong, apparently. Who knew?
So we've challenged someone's worldview, hopefully, with our podcast, which we like to do.
So on that nicely satisfying conclusion, we'll see you next week. Hopefully, perhaps. Maybe.
See you there, whatever happens.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.